Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Organized Chaos. It's hosted by former NFL coach Rex Ryan and his former Jets and Ravens linebacker Bart Scott. The duo will be reunited in this weekly podcast with new episodes every Monday that will provide listeners with expert insight and analysis on everything happening around the league, featuring trending stories from on and off the field. That's Organized Chaos. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Also, our annual NBA opening night doubleheader is Wednesday, October 20th. Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, and the Celtics are at Madison Square Garden to take on Julius Randle, former Celtic Kemba Walker, and the Knicks at 7:30 Eastern, 4:30 Pacific. Then it's our primetime West Coast game with reigning MVP Nikola Jokic and the Nuggets in Phoenix squaring off against Devin Booker, Chris Paul, and the Suns, last season's Western Conference champs. Two great matchups to tip off the NBA season on ESPN and the ESPN app. One app, one tap. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about what happened this weekend with the Washington football team. Also, those stories about the time your parents embarrassed you. But first, all right, so Ed Orgeron, like, he ain't been fully fired yet, but he's going to be fired. We got word on Sunday that LSU and Orgeron have been working on a separation agreement and that he will coach out the rest of this season, but he will not coach in 2022. And now what might be the best coaching job in college football comes open. And my argument for this perhaps being the best coaching job in college football is fairly simple. Both Les Miles and Ed Orgeron won national championships there. I mean, what more you need, dog? Like, those dudes can win there. All right, there we go. But, I mean, this is about Orgeron. Like, this isn't so much about LSU, though it is kind of about LSU. Now, one thing you cannot forget is that there's a, you know, significant Title IX investigation going on with LSU, and there have been some allegations about Orgeron and how seriously he did not take allegations of sexual assault against his players. Like, there's some serious stuff that's been going on there at LSU, but ultimately Orgeron is getting tossed because he lost. Like, losing is the thing that did it, right? Like, we could stack up all the things that really, really, really matter, but none of them did him in, like people looking around and realizing ultimately that dude was probably not going to be able to win there the way that they wanted to win, especially not after it seems that in various forms and fashions he lost his mind up in here. So one thing worth remembering about college football coaches, or basically anybody that we talk about here, they are people, right? And very often people stuff happens to them. And the things that are really hard for regular people to deal with are often the case for these guys. Now, what you sometimes have with guys in these positions, but honestly not but so often, because they wouldn't be able to be in those positions if this happened but so often, but you deal with people sometimes who just struggle to hold on. And Ed Orgeron is one of those people who struggles to hold on. And I say that absent any judgment, right? Like, if you're familiar with this story, he had a history of alcoholism, for example, he had to take care of and get that in line. He has a legendarily explosive temper, and as things got bad at LSU, that temper started to show itself more and more. Like, that's who he is. This is a high pressure job, and this is a dude that does not react well to pressure. Right? That's what we have here. And so we're getting stories now that have come out. I think Ross Dellinger of Sports Illustrated had one that talked about this, like chair throwing when nobody's around, that kind of thing. Like, that's where Orgeron is. So he's one of these cats. One thing that's very important about how well you do your job as a college football coach is how things go when they're not going well. Like, if you can handle things decently while things aren't going well, you can buy yourself some time for a turnaround. Orgeron isn't that guy. So when this started to fall off, there really wasn't any time that he was going to be able to buy himself to turn this around. Now, there is precedent for a coach winning a national championship and then being fired 2 years later. Gene Chizik had that happen with him at Auburn. But the difference is Chizik went winless in the SEC in that 2012 season. If you go winless in the conference, you're going to get fired. Even at Vanderbilt, pretty much, you go winless in the conference, you're going to get fired, okay? That's not how it happened with Orgeron. They just beat Florida. But LSU had that thing in, I believe it's 2015, where they let the fans convince them to keep Les Miles. After they won that, you know, the word had gotten out they were going to fire Les Miles, and then the fans really rallied around them, and then they dumbasses decided, okay, well, maybe we can give it another year, and then fired them something like four games into the season next year. They weren't going to let that happen again. Like, word got out that they beat Florida. Them LSU fans got that lemon booty, afraid they was going to get stuck with Orgeron. And they're like, nah, don't worry. We got our eyes on the prize, baby. We got our eyes on the prize. We're going to get Orgeron up out of here. And thereby, Orgeron was gone. But don't get this twisted. The only thing that got him fired was losing. That was it. Now, let's get to why you here. Because it's really why I'm here, okay? Now, I'm talking about Orgeron and the struggle to hold on or whatever. Okay, cool. And I talk about, you got to remember that this dude is a person. The reason I mentioned that you got to remember that this dude is a person is because Brody Miller of The Athletic wrote a really good story that, by the way, dropped like an hour after Orgeron, the word got out that Orgeron was getting fired. I said on Twitter that they were waiting to press publish on that, like the Miami Herald was with that Castro obituary. Like, we know it's only a matter of time. We've been working on this and getting it ready. Ain't no way in the world you got a story that good and that detailed ready. He ain't just slapped that thing together. That had already been through editorial. They like, nah, don't worry, man. They gonna fire this dude soon. Just you wait. And when they do, we gonna be on it. And my man was on it. And it's a really good story. Dellinger had also a very good story in Sports Illustrated because Dellinger used to cover LSU. He had a really good story also in Sports Illustrated, but his didn't go where Miller's did, which is to what I would call the very human place. Dellinger kind of did, but not really. And so here's the human place with Orgeron and why I found Miller's story to be so interesting. Ed Orgeron was such a wonderful story when they won that national championship in January of 2020. And do not forget, that 2019 LSU team was dominant, right? We're not talking about some team that just scraped by to win a national championship. They were a legitimately great team, like potentially all-time great team, but they were a legitimately great team, okay? So Ed Orgeron, who famously flamed out at Ole Miss, who was largely viewed and seen as a caricature in college football. Not that he wasn't a good defensive line coach or not that he wasn't a good recruiter, but Ed Orgeron talks like Ed Orgeron talks. And so as a result, Ed Orgeron became a bit of a cartoon figure. But when LSU hired him, I remember I was talking to Ryan Clark about that. And I was like, is this really a good idea? Because I felt like they made the mistake of hiring the interim. Like, hiring the interim is always a dicey game. And I asked him, I was like, you sure this is a good idea? And Ryan said, he's an LSU grad. He said, you got to understand, he's perfect for us. Like, he probably doesn't fit anywhere else, but he's perfect for us. And the truth of the matter is, he was. Because Orgeron could be the man out front, and then what you do was very similar to what Clemson has done. Spend the money you need to get great coordinators, and then go from there. So they were paying Dave Aranda to be the defensive coordinator, and Dave Aranda was the highest paid defensive coordinator in America at the time, right? They went and got Joe Brady from the Saints, which is a really inspired hire, and the offense exploded. So Orgeron is on top of the world. The job he always wanted was to be the coach at LSU because he's a Louisiana dude. That's what he always wanted. He wanted to be the coach at LSU, and he wasn't just the coach at LSU. He was the coach at LSU to win a national championship. And you got to remember, when Ed Orgeron was growing up, LSU was sorry. Like, the prospect of winning a national championship there was absurd. He won a national championship there. He got himself a contract extension, 6 years, $42 million. He's the highest paid employee of the state of Louisiana. He is the king of Louisiana. And then, like, weeks after the national championship, he got divorced. And this is where I say you have to remember that fundamentally, we're talking about people. Divorce ravages people's lives. Divorce turns people sometimes into different folks. They lost. They trying to figure out how to do it, how to pull it off, all of this stuff. And it sounded like Ogeron had one of them wives that he credited for like stabilizing his life, calming him down, getting him in check. You know what I mean? Like one of those situations. And so now that woman is gone and Ed Ogeron got a pocket full of money and Ed Ogeron is the king of Louisiana and the head coach at LSU and all of that stuff. All right. Now, divorce happens a lot in sports in various fashions and capacities. And we just don't generally talk about it because it's just, it's a personal sort of thing, right? Like it's the subtext of Jimbo Fisher and things falling apart at Florida State before he went to Texas A&M is divorce. That is an inflection point there that a lot of people in Tallahassee point to when it all started going down. The man just seemed like he didn't feel like doing his damn job no more, right? Like that's an example of one of those things. Ryan Sandberg once retired after 1 month in the season in baseball because he was going through a divorce and it was tearing him apart. He came back the next year, I want to say. But like, this is the thing that happens. But when divorce like messed things up for Ed Ogeron, it wasn't in a sad way, right? Like I say that about Jimbo Fisher. I'm like, damn, you see what was going on over there? He looked like a brand new man over there at Texas A&M. I talk about that with Ryan Sandberg. Damn, man couldn't even bother to come to work. Nah. You know what divorce did to Ed Ogeron? Combined with a pocket full of money and fame and notoriety like he never had. That had Ed Ogeron out here in these streets. On them, I tell you, on them. And if you have not heard this particular anecdote about Ed Ogeron and him being on them in these streets, I'm going to read this one for you from the Brody Miller story in The Athletic. And that story goes as follows. Okay, you ready? I just want you all to brace yourselves for this. I just want everybody to brace themselves. All right. To people and sources inside the program, there was no moral issue with Ogeron enjoying his life, but it was noticeable that football wasn't his entire focus like it had been in the past, and it became a distraction. There was the infamous 2020 photo of him in bed with a woman, among other photos made public. Multiple sources said he brought women around the LSU football operations building. It all took place as his decision-making and coach performance declined. It was just a distraction, one player said. In 2019, there was no what's Coach O doing post-game or Sunday during the day. Is he laying by the pool with a lady? He was planning events other than football. It created messes for him, like the time Ogeron pulled up to a woman at a gas station wearing exercise attire. Hey, you look like you work out, he said, according to multiple sources. We could work out together. The woman informed Ogeron she was married and pregnant, to which he responded, why does that matter? The woman was the wife of a high-ranking LSU official. Word of this reached the LSU Board of Supervisors, the collection of prominent Louisiana attorneys and business owners appointed by the governor who make the most important decisions at LSU. And of course, it reached Athletic Director Scott Woodward. Now, I need to be clear about something because I didn't say it right. I said that Ogeron pulled up to a woman at a gas station wearing exercise attire. Hey, you look like you work out, he said, according to multiple sources. When you know what he said was, hey, you look like you work out. We can work out together. The woman informed Ogeron she was married and pregnant, to which he responded, why does that matter? Hey, man. I understand the man's single. He get to live his life. I could be wrong here. You guys let me know if I'm tripping. You tell me if I'm off on this. But my thinking is that, like, once you the head coach at LSU, you can't really be parking lot pimping at the Shamrock no more. Okay? You guys may not know about the Shamrock, but down that way, that's one of the corner stores. I don't know what the reigning corner store is in Louisiana right now. In Houston, we had Stop and Go, right? We had the Diamond Shamrock. You boys in Philly, y'all got the Wawa. You know what I mean? We got the Quick Trip in Atlanta. Everybody got that place. And Ogeron cannot be at these places spitting game at people randomly. This is not what it is. And what you found out was he was that guy. What guy? That guy. She says she's married and pregnant. Why does that matter? I didn't know Ed Ogeron was a UGK fan. I had no idea that this was his sort of approach. But this is what Ed Ogeron was doing. And then we got another report from a news outlet in Louisiana. It said in that one that he had women at the football facility. Oh, no. He was going farther than that. They said that Ed Orgeron was letting them bring their kids with them and then letting their kids participate in drills at practice. Gabe, were you aware of that one?
I was aware of it all in one huge dump because I read the story in stories, so my eyes just got wider and wider as I progressively read through everything.
Yes, yes. Look, here's what Ed Orgeron was doing, man. I have talked about this before, I believe, on this podcast. I've said this many times. I do not like to be simple and be like, you know what women love, that kind of stuff, right? Like, I ain't trying to talk like no love doctor type guy. But in my travels, if there's anything that I've seen that is as universally effective in impressing women is let them see you be in charge of something, of some people, of some place. Any place where you walk in the room and you run it, that is the most attractive thing that I have found that you as man can typically do. Particularly if you as man are not that attractive all on your own. Walk in a room, run the place, be the man. It ain't even gotta be the biggest room in the world, right? You could be in charge of some little committee at your job. You could be a third grade teacher and just tell the kids to all sit down. It don't matter. Be in charge of something. And Ed Orgeron, whose whole life is football, until all of a sudden he was back in these streets and he was back on them, he got to leverage the thing he's got. And the thing he's got is being the coach at LSU. So what's Ed Orgeron doing? Why don't you come watch me coach football? And then next thing you know, it's women at there and you bring in the kids. Hey, little man. I hear you want to be a football player. Have you ever heard of Oklahoma? I see you brought one of your friends with you. How would you boys like to participate in the Oklahoma drill? Next thing you know, Ed Orgeron got 2 9-year-olds lined up face to face with each other. Come on, team. Cheer them on. And now you got kids out here doing the damn Oklahoma drill. I don't know if he actually did the Oklahoma drill with them, because honestly, you would need to call somebody about that if he had done the Oklahoma drill with them. But don't tell me for a second that Orgeron had not considered that maybe those kids would enjoy a good Oklahoma drill if they wanted to get out here and be like they were players. Who does this? Who does this? Like, I've heard of a lot of different jobs. Like, your wife can show up. This girl you hollering at right now. Probably not the person to show up at practice. And Ed Orgeron had him there. And this is another level that I bet Ed Orgeron has not considered, man. I do not want to lean in on a trope, but I will say it is highly likely, entirely possible that there are young men on that team who grew up without fathers, right? There are probably young men who, as a result of that, grew up where their mom was bringing dudes over who remind them a lot of what Ed Orgeron was doing. And I assure you that a lot of those dudes hate those guys' guts. Like, you are demonstrating yourself to a certain segment of the population of your football team to be a man that is beneath their respect. You remind them of a lot of things that they didn't like in the first place. They know this is crazy. They know this is absurd. And for a bunch of them, they know it wasn't always like this before. But now all of a sudden you out here and you got that whatchamacallit on your brain. I can't think of a time that having that whatchamacallit on your brain has ruined a dude's career at a college football program like this. I can't think of any story at all like this. At all. Now, let me tell you something else that's interesting for me to think about. Now, one thing I noticed is they didn't give a time, a date exactly on that encounter when Ed Orgeron was like, we can work out together. Terrible line, by the way. Never going to work. But we don't have a time on when that was. I would like to know exactly when that was. Because, like, was that before the 2020 season started? And, you know, it kind of went bad, right? Like that, or did that happen after the fact? And the reason I ask is, how much winning were they willing to put up with such that Ed Orgeron was pulling that and, like, wouldn't immediately let go? I mean, I don't even know if that's necessarily immediately fireable, because honestly, it's a bit of a bad break, right? Like, of all the women in the world, she had to be married to him. You know, like, maybe that's what it is. I don't know. But, like, if Ed Orgeron was out here and they were, like, 9-0, they would have still rolled with it. If they were 9-0 this year, that dude that had a problem with Ed Orgeron hollering at his woman, he might have watched Ed spit game and been like, oh, coach is so charming. They were willing to put up with all kinds of stuff in the name of winning. And then it went away. The winning was gone. And now we get these stories. Did you see the one, Gabe, about somebody called up the call-in show? Like, this, I think, is actually interesting and a testament to the way that we cover these things. So Ross Dellinger's story had a report that somebody called into the call-in show and was like, hey, my daughter's in the crowd. Can you find her? And Elsrod's looking around. Hey, what she at? I don't see her. And the guy's like, no, she's not there. Do not pursue my daughter romantically. Like, this is the call-in show that goes out on the radio. And there's normally somebody who covers the call-in show. If you got somebody on the college beat, there's somebody who covers the call-in show because there's typically something worth hearing on the call-in show. All right? So that happened. And then after they got the guy off the phone, Orgeron says something to the effect of, in the bayou, we got fishing holes where we take people like that. A dude threatened to kill somebody on the radio. How did we only find this out after he got fired? Like, seriously, how did that happen? How did that right there? That's something that is immediate when that comes up, or at the very least becomes like a chatter that bounces around in college football places where I would have come across it. It was presented in that story like, yo, I bet there's something you don't know. How is that possible? The football coach just threatened to kill a fan. How is that possible? You can't have that. You just can't. But the bottom line, Ed, a wild boy, man. Like, every story that came out about this just falls in line with Ed, a wild boy, right? Keep it in mind that this is the dude where there's a story that when he took the job at Ole Miss, that he came in the locker room and said, because they had David Cutcliffe, who's now the coach at Duke, was the coach at Ole Miss before Orgeron. And that Ed comes in the locker room to meet the players for the first time. Is there anybody in here that is still loyal to Coach Cutcliffe? There's a couple of them that raised their hands. Ed Orgeron took off his shirt and challenged them to fight. Like I told you, this is the dude with struggles to hold on and everything else, right? And this could really be a story about your struggles. And then we found out that he trying to holler at him at the stop and go. And then all of a sudden, this became hilarious. It's not just that he tried to holler at her. It's that she hit him back with, I'm married and pregnant. And he's like, what's your man got to do with me? That was not going to dissuade Ed Orgeron. Like, and I don't blame this woman for this, obviously, because I'm sure she was just trying to get out of the situation. But I'm going to tell you this right now. If a dude hits you with the line, maybe we can work out together. I'm married, ain't going to stop him, and neither is I'm pregnant. Those are two irrelevant things to a gentleman like Ed Orgeron. He does not care at all about those things. Like, I'm not surprised that Ed Orgeron is a Dirty Mac. But could you just take a moment to imagine all the various forms of Dirty Mackin' that Ed Orgeron could perhaps engage in? And I did that. And I thought about what it would be like, kind of, if Ed Orgeron had one of them Time Life albums where Ed Orgeron sang the hits. Gabe, are you young enough to remember when they'd had the commercials for like Time Life commercials where they just put together basically compilations and it would be like a 2-minute commercial that would just have a portion of a song and then some, you know, they were like, listen to your favorite romantic anthems like this one from James Taylor. And then they play one and then go, you know, all down the line. Man, I got all kinds of Ed Orgeron Dirty Mac classics that you could imagine. After Ed Orgeron ran up on her at that parking lot, you know what kind of game he's spitting. He's basically Cajun Joe.
I'll take you to places he will not, and some you never knew would get you hot.
That's Ed Orgeron, right there. That's him.
That's around in Louisiana. He listened to Juvenile.
Let me pour some more Hip and Hennessy in your glass.
This is Ed Ogeron, ladies and gentlemen. This is the guy. He would be on that same street with Michael Jackson in the middle of the night for reasons that nobody understands.
Hey, pretty baby with the high heels on.
That's Ed Ogeron. You also have to understand this, man. Ed Ogeron got some money now. He's learned some things about how the world go. And you know what he learned?
What a rich player, won't you? And your man can't do nothing for you. These girls ain't loyal.
Ed's learned. Ed's learned. He has figured this out. Ed, she's talking about, I am married and I am pregnant.
Hold on now. Every woman needs her own Splacavelli.
I would love to hear Ed Ogeron sing a full rendition of Splacavelli myself. And with the Louisiana, the Baton Rouge in his soul, that woman tried to tell me I'm pregnant.
You know you want a girl. Don't act like you don't want a girl. You want her just as bad as I do.
He's doing all of this. And now he don't have no job. But you know what he still got? He still got all that money. He still has every dime of it. He's going to be doing all the same stuff, except now he's got all the time in the world. I just want to tell you this, Ed Ogeron. Be very careful, because not everybody takes that as well as that high-ranking official. And you may meet a gentleman who has two options for you. Settling it with some class or getting off in some gangster shit. Have it your way. We did Foxworth Friday last week, and we recorded that on Thursday, and we were recording it either the same day or the day before or the day after Washington, the football team, announced that they were going to be retiring Sean Taylor's jersey. And it was a really just kind of odd and strange situation because they had a lot of events planned around honoring Sean Taylor, but nobody had heard anything about retiring his jersey. And that's a thing. Like, that matters because, honestly, if you were going to retire Sean Taylor's jersey, you would have already done it. Like, the standard typically for retiring somebody's jersey is being a Hall of Famer. Like, it's not easy to get your jersey retired for any team, right? That's just, it's normally, you got to be a Hall of Famer. And Sean Taylor could have been a Hall of Famer, but ultimately did not get there. Like, when somebody dies under circumstances like the ones he died under, if you're going to do it, like with Pat Tillman, which obviously is not the same as Sean Taylor, but you do that immediately. There's no waiting. There's no going through committee or anything. And it really doesn't feel like anything you drop on people on just a couple of days' notice. And the thing with that team is, they one of them squads where you can't tell if what they doing is malice or incompetence. You know, like you can never get a gauge on it. And so a lot of discussion came about. A lot of people had a whole lot of things to say and a lot of questions. Now, I'm going to read to you this tweet from a gentleman named Chad Ryan who covers this team. I believe he's got a blog covering this team. Okay. They rededicated a road and called it Sean Taylor Road. The road was rededicated in front of porta potties. The sideline number tribute was in the area where VIPs stand. The halftime ceremony involved no speeches or recognition. The owner wore a hoodie to the pregame meeting with the family. Now, this is outright disrespectful, and I would note, I honestly believe beneath Dan Snyder, and I understand that nobody really thinks very highly of Dan Snyder. I don't really think very highly of Dan Snyder, but there's really only one thing in this world that I am certain that Dan Snyder loves, and it's that football team and players on it. Like, that's always been him. And so the idea that they would treat this what I would term so callously really, really just bothers me. And the reason it bothers me is, for those of you who were younger, you kind of had to be there, like in abroad there, when Sean Taylor died, and like in some total when Sean Taylor played. Because the story, to me, of his career is like low-key more tragic than we give it credit for being. Like, I remember, I think it was in the year 05. Yeah, I think it was 2005. Tom Friend wrote this really long, thorough story on what was going wrong with that football team at the time. And one of the big things that was going on is Greg Williams was the defensive coordinator at the time. And for some reason, had them running this cover two, where Sean Taylor and Adam Archuleta were covering two sides of the, like one half of the field, one half of the field, like all the time. Which, for those of you who can't remember Sean Taylor as a player, the closest comp I could give you now is Derwin James, like a guy who could as easily be a free safety as he could be a middle linebacker, except Derwin James is not as good as Sean Taylor was, and that's no slight to Derwin James. Like, that's the type of dude he got. You don't take a dude like that and just tell him to cover one half of the field. Like, that's not the kind of thing that you do. And the guy on the other side, he's slow. He can't cover the whole side. Right. And so in 05, Sean Taylor as a football player is lost. And people are just talking about how he's in his own head and everything else because he doesn't know what to do. And then 06 comes around and like now he starts figuring it out. Now he's going on this path that looks like he can become one of the greatest players of all time. But what was also going on in a similar time is that he had gotten in some off the field stuff. Right. Like, I think somebody had stolen his jet ski. And so, you know, Sean Taylor from Florida, he did the kind of thing you do in Florida. If somebody steals your jet ski, you run up on them with the tool. I understand why that sort of thing can be offensive to a lot of you, but I'm from Texas, so that just sounds like a kind of thing that people do. Like, you probably shouldn't have, don't get me wrong, but it's not like, oh my God, it's such a terrible thing. What's wrong with him? It doesn't get me to that place. But Sean Taylor was that guy for a lot of people in the media, and he looked the part. This big old, giant, darker-skinned black dude with the locks, and this is as dreadlocks are becoming like a super duper NFL thing, like the Florida influence is coming, but he looked like he scared a lot of people to death just by walking in the room. And so then you add this to the story and he fits this picture. And so Taylor was shot, and people I have looked up to in this industry and people I respect said embarrassing, borderline slanderous things about Sean Taylor. Like, they were careful not to say anything illegal at the time, but without knowing what went on, a whole lot of people blamed that man for being shot to death, basically. And then we found out what happened was just a sad story, man. Some teenagers broke into his house. He goes downstairs with a machete, leaves the bedroom with a machete, trying to protect the family. He didn't have a gun for whatever reason, trying to protect the family. And basically, it just sounds like this teenage kid got scared, closed his eyes, and shot. I think he got him in the thigh, like a femoral artery situation. But you know what I mean? Like, when it just all comes together, it's just a really sad story. But the part that I just don't think has ever been played up enough. Pat Tillman died the way he saw it, protecting America. And when I say the way he saw it, I'm just trying to avoid whatever thoughts you have about what that war was in Afghanistan. But that's, regardless of what you think about that, that's what Pat Tillman thought he was doing. He died protecting America. Sean Taylor died protecting his family, which, you say what you want to me, that's pretty damn heroic. People like to look at it like Sean Taylor like died the death of a hoodlum, and in reality is he died the death of a hero. I can think of no more noble way for someone to end. He gave his life to protect his family. If it was a different person, we would just talk about that all the time because of the obvious heroism of what took place, you know? And again, people were blaming him for his death before the body was even cold. Like, that's where people were when it came with him. And so once they decide they're going to do this Sean Taylor stuff, man, you got to do this up. Like, you really, really, really have to do this up. We often get these guys and we forget this. We get them very young, man. We get them in their early 20s. We get them as they're trying to figure out their lives. We get them as they're finding their paths. And this dude professionally had found his path and had a measure of stability in his life at that point. And then it was just gone. And now when it's your time to honor him, the owner can't even bother to put on no shirt and tie. Y'all couldn't even bother to do this, like, to get this right. And I'm looking at this picture right now of his family standing in front of Port-a-Johns. Right? And then you got, I think it's Patrick Mahomes' goofy little brother, like, taking a TikTok on top of the number 21 that's on the field. Ironically, as the song says, I ain't no lame, and you the lamest dude in the world. did you really, and we don't have any, like, no one will be able to definitively say this yes or no, but did you really just throw this man's memory and legacy out there to defend yourselves against criticism? Like, did you really do that? Because if you did, this is one of the lowest things you ever could have done. And I want to make this point right now, if this is what they did. Jason Wright, the new CEO that they hired, I guess a couple years ago, or last year, whenever it was, he wrote a letter that was like, hey, we messed up. We thought it would be better to make this as a surprise or whatever, but we got this wrong. And he basically laid out on his sword. Given how the situation had gone last week, I thought it was a great statement for them to put out. Thought it seemed very sincere. But it's becoming harder to believe now. I can't say if he's lying, right? But it's becoming harder to believe. And if this was a falsehood, I would just simply like to take a moment to say, I told y'all. And when I say I told y'all, y'all dumbasses was out here in the streets all happy. Hey, they hired a black dude to run things. I'm like, don't none of that matter because it's the same team. You know what I mean? And I'm not putting this on Jason Wright necessarily because I just question how much power he actually has. But it's like, oh man, maybe it'll be a change. They put a new CEO in charge. This looked like the same shit they've been pulling for this football team for as long as I can remember. This looked like the exact same way. And I told y'all, putting this dude out here, who, by the way, comes from a very similar background as all kinds of stuff that most of y'all don't like. Putting this dude out here wasn't going to change nothing. And he went out there and put out what I thought was a very, very, very sincere statement about all of this, right? And none of this sincerity seemed to come through in the way they handled the actual event. And that is unforgivable. If you haven't heard, as part of ESPN Nation, brought to you by Dr. Pepper, college football is back, and so are the fans. Return to glory with Fansville by Dr. Pepper, the one fans deserve.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bomani, this first story comes from science.
This is Theodore Kim. I'm a professor of computer science at Yale University and a former senior scientist at Pixar Animation Studios. I'm here to warn you that in the future, self-driving cars might start running over black people. Tesla is currently under a federal investigation because the self-driving feature on their cars keeps crashing into ambulances. One explanation for this is that the AIs that drive these cars are not used to seeing emergency vehicles. What does this have to do with black people? Well, the way that these AIs work is that they watch tons of dashcam videos to learn how to drive. If those videos don't have lots of examples of how to slow down near ambulances, the AI will do something weird when it sees one in real life, like crash into it. Now, there's a cheap way to fix this, and that's to show the AI tons of fake dashcam footage. These fake videos never happened. They were instead conjured out of ones and zeros using the same algorithms that Hollywood uses to make CGI Moana and The Incredible Hulk. It's actually cheaper than going out and chasing ambulances just to get footage of them. Now the problem is, when it comes to people, these Hollywood algorithms were designed to make realistic-looking white people. They were built specifically to depict the soft glow of young white skin, not the shine on dark black skin. Next time you watch a movie or play a video game containing a CGI black person, look at the shine on the skin. It'll either be totally missing or it'll look all messed up. So what's going to happen when AI start thinking that that's what black people are supposed to look like? Will they start running over black paramedics? Better watch out. The future could look like a horror movie.
First of all, shout out to you, Professor Kim, for coming out hot. He's like, your car could start running over black people. I am in. Like, that was perfect presentation in a way that academics typically do not give you. Also, what a fascinating story. Like the way he described, yo, you are really good at this, Professor Kim. Shout out to you.
Yeah, I mean, and he brings up another interesting point that's going to cause a lot of people to look at Madden and look at all these other video games, all these other movies, CGI, a whole different way maybe that they hadn't looked at before.
Yeah, no, damn. Like, I hadn't thought about any of these things. I don't watch too many movies that involve, like, all that futuristic stuff. I like my movie with people in it. But damn, I'm a little bit shook now. And let me tell you something. If the Tesla just starts automatically running over black people, you better be very afraid if you are in Atlanta. Because the Tesla is everywhere there, boy. Good gracious. And guess what else is everywhere in Atlanta? That's right. People that CGI can't get right.
All right. This next story comes from tech.
Every time you open Facebook, there are hundreds of posts, maybe thousands, it could show you in your newsfeed. Think about all the posts from all the people you've ever friended on there, all the pages you've followed, all the groups you've joined. The software that decides which ones you actually see is known as the newsfeed algorithm. There's similar algorithms on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. They decide which posts go mega viral, which ones are like a tree falling in a forest with nobody around. And lawmakers are starting to think those algorithms are a problem for society. Testimony from a whistleblower named Frances Haugen has focused Congress's attention on the many ways that Facebook manipulates its algorithm to juice growth, to keep us hooked, in some cases, even to try to mitigate harm, like when they hide posts that might contain hate speech or misinformation. Haugen says Facebook does too much of the former and not enough of the latter. She and other critics of the social media companies are calling for laws that focus on regulating those algorithms. Specifically, there's a slew of new proposals that would allow people to sue social media platforms like Facebook when those platforms' algorithms spread or amplify posts that cause real harms. And that's a shift from previous conversations where critics have talked about what people are allowed to say on Facebook, which posts it leaves up, which ones it takes down. There are a lot of reasons why we should be wary of forcing social media platforms to tightly control what their users can post. The idea behind focusing on the algorithms is that they're something the companies actually have control over. They can decide whether their algorithms prioritize posts that get tons of likes, posts that generate lots of conversation or comments, posts that generate lots of angry reaction emojis, or posts that their users think are actually worthwhile or informative. And those decisions made by these companies affect what news we all get, how we think about politics and culture, how we talk to each other online. But some lawyers warn that shifting the focus to the algorithms doesn't necessarily solve the problem. Private companies like Facebook can decide what people say on their platforms, but when the government gets involved in those decisions, even in a tangential way, there can be First Amendment concerns. And some activists argue that if we force social media companies to abandon their algorithms, or to be a lot more cautious about what their algorithms amplify, we might lose a lot of good speech along with the bad, including speech by marginalized groups, social movements. It's a tough issue, but it is an interesting new front in the broader bipartisan push to try to rein in the power that big tech companies have gained over all of our lives.
Do the old people just really not get like how truly important Facebook is? Because one thing about Congress, maybe they just don't get how the social media stuff works, and that's why they seem to be so ignorant on these things, except they do because they leverage this stuff in order to win elections. Right? Like this is the tool that they use. It's not as though they may not be on Facebook themselves every day in order to get a handle on what's going on. But when it's time for them to run a campaign, they're talking to people about what we're going to do on Facebook. And I'm sure they asked some questions on that. They know what time it is. And in fact, some of these people in Congress are the ones that engage in the misinformation and all of that stuff. They all play on this. And so what you then wind up with is a legitimate question to ask. If you are a politician, do you have any positive incentive to reform the Facebook algorithm? Because it's serving the purposes of what they want. Like, this is the kind of thing that needs to be regulated by some non-elected independent board, right? Like, those are the kinds of people that have to do that. Because otherwise, the people that are like, so what you're telling me is I can put a lie out here and people will believe that it's true? Hey, like, I'd love to hear those hearings. So yeah, tell me more about the techniques that people are using in order to spread this misinformation so we can learn how to stop it.
All right, this last story also comes from tech.
Hi, I'm Jeremy B. Merrill, and I'm a data reporter with the Washington Post. Cryptocurrency is a big business. So is stealing it. So much so that a set of 10 web addresses that mimic the names of some popular cryptocurrency exchanges sold last year and early this year for $220,000. When I visited those websites, the sites looked identical to the real versions of the sites whose names they were mimicking, and they showed signs of using what are called phishing toolkits, off-the-shelf software meant to help hackers steal your password. The most expensive of those web addresses, www.blockchain.com, there's no dot between the www and blockchain, sold for $56,000 worth of Bitcoin. Another one, connybase.com, that's Coinbase, but with the N and the I switched, sold for $16,000. This is surprising, cybersecurity experts tell me, because the people who run these phishing scams usually run a volume game, buying the cheapest web addresses as possible, because they know that each individual one is pretty likely to get detected and blocked pretty quickly. The prices of web addresses on the secondary market usually isn't public, but earlier this year, hackers from Anonymous broke into an internet company called Epic, which is notorious not for cybercrime, but for hosting extremist far-right content from people like Nazis and Proud Boys. Epic told me that they're not responsible for what their customers do. Epic also does a lot of business with people who buy and sell domain names, which is often totally legitimate. But that's why we get this rare look into the sales records that show the scope and scale of some of these sophisticated, high-dollar cryptocurrency phishing efforts.
You know, I have a hard time feeling sympathy for people when they get got trying to play funny money games. It's tough. But damn, that's kind of messed up. They played on the typo. You know what was funny too? When you sent me the email with this in it, and that story was in the Washington Post, and you put in here, Jeremy's story is up at washingpost.com. Gabe tried to get me on the scam. I'm afraid to click on that. I might mess around and think I'm buying some Bitcoin and get got.
I'm sorry, my man.
Oh, no, it's all good. It just happened to be funny that it was on that particular one. But like the one where it's just like no dot in the middle, just that's a brilliant way to go about this.
And then being able to mimic the site itself so that it looks exactly like it, and the people who are committing that typo have no idea that they committed said typo and are fished.
Yes. Yes. Damn. Better you than me.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bo. What brought to light this very interesting and very good topic? I'm kind of actually surprised that we haven't done it before.
Yeah, I just was bouncing around some thoughts. And honestly, we're running out of stuff, baby. Came up with a new one.
The time when your parents embarrassed you, that's actually like, we can go to the well on that one. I feel like that one's going to be a consistent one because we got a lot of good ones. Our first one, consistent theme, we didn't get any names on any of these.
So back in college, my dad invited me into this fancy football league with him and his other older friends. So naturally, I thought, easy payday, bunch of old guys. So we get to the draft, and it's an in-person draft with all the stickers and whatnot. So I have the first pick. I select Todd Gurley, and this was back when he was on the Rams. And my dad, being a Rams fan, thought it would be funny to start talking a little smack to me. So, you know, me feeling myself, I'm 19, feeling good. Can't let, you know, him embarrass me in front of these strangers. So I talk a little smack back. Ends up getting a little physical. Well, before you know it, Bo, next thing I know, I'm on the ground in a chokehold in front of all these random strangers. They start throwing snacks at me. I don't know what's going on. I have to tap out immediately. And next thing I know, I have to sit there for the next 18 rounds with not only a bruised ego, but a bruised back. I'm not sure which one's worse. Anyway, thanks for listening, Bo. The show's great. Keep doing what you're doing.
Why did you have to stay? I feel like you could leave.
You had to finish drafting his team.
Because I'm about my team right now. How could you still be in this league? I would no longer want to be in this league. None of them respected you for stay. Next thing you know, it got a little physical. I really want to know those steps before it got physical. I ain't never heard about it getting physical at the fantasy football draft. Wow. And then he took you to the, in front of people? Y'all got beef. I want to know where the beef come from. Y'all got beef.
Another time when voicemail topics collide.
Yes.
The time when you scrapped it out with your old man.
Right. I was thinking embarrassed in a completely different context.
The other ones I selected are more in line with the context, but I just thought that one was kind of too good to pass.
Oh, no, no. It was good. Don't get me wrong. I'm just like, for him, I was like, yo, you heard something different than I was saying when you called it.
All right. Our next one. Another good one. Here it is.
Well, you had to bring up embarrassing parent stories. I had to give mine out, and I've never forgiven my mama for this. It's 1993, living in Brooklyn. Mama took us to the Baptist church, and my mama thought she could sing. My mama been singing around the house since I was little, knowing we can't do nothing about it. But my father, God rest his soul, good man, always kept that in check and said, hey, you're a great singer for the house, not for public. She decided one day she was going to go out and try out for the church choir. They had choir practice, and my mama decided she going to do it, and she wanted a solo. And with the whole congregation who came out for practice and the young lady who was two rows in front of me who I was trying to kick it to, she decided to sing Amazing Grace. My mama's voice sounded like she'd been gargling razor blades, and everything about that song was terrible, and the whole congregation looking at us laughing, pointing, and snickering. And in that moment, I felt humiliation and embarrassment on levels I have never felt in my entire life. I looked at my brother who was sitting to my right, my daddy who was sitting to the left. My daddy put his head down and said, boys, I got this. Went up halfway through the song, pulled my mama off the stage, apologized to the congregation. We grabbed our stuff. We walked to the door. Suffice to say, 2 weeks later, my parents had a whole new church. 3 weeks later, I had a whole new religion. That's when you get embarrassed.
in front of everybody, and I have never let my mama live that one down. Take it easy, bro.
Hold on, a whole new religion? Which one did y'all get? Yo, daddy had to go be the Sandman. Damn. Nothing like when somebody can't sing in a church, though. Don't nobody know what to do. You ever been in a wedding when somebody couldn't sing? I have. It's tough.
Yeah, sometimes you're protecting people from themselves, right? But then others don't feel shame.
Nah. He wasn't protecting her from himself. He was protecting himself from her and what she was doing to the family name. That's so bad, they had to lead a whole damn church. Damn. God love people who can't sing, too.
I'd love a to-be-continued on that story.
I would. Again, I need to know what the new church was. And did she try to sing there?
All right. Our last one to close this out. Another good one. Here it is.
Hi, Bo. So my mother unintentionally put me in one of the most embarrassing spots ever. Summer of 76, I was about 6 years old. And the circus used to come to town, Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey. And that year, they ran a promotion. My mother actually put my name into a raffle for tickets. And lo and behold, we were the grand prize winners. So what we did was she took us out. We were the old New Haven Coliseum. We get there. We go to Will Call. They pull me aside. They tell my mother that midway through the show, a clown would come get me for a big ceremony. Sure enough, here come these clowns, which, once again, it was 1976, so our parents let us go willingly. There were all these group of kids who won, but I was the grand prize winner. What that entailed was, at the midpoint of the show, they announced us. And me and the two other co-winners were now standing. We came up to a platform in the middle of the circus, in the middle of the crowd, with the circus around us. So we're standing in the middle of this place on a platform, and I am wearing a red, white, and blue sequin jacket, a red, white, and blue sequin hat, and waving to the crowd. It is almost Rocky IV, Living in America. And I'm sitting there, and not only that's going on, but I'm angry, because all the lower winners are riding in carriages and carts being pulled by the animals all around the center, all around the ring of the circus. Luckily for me, there were no iPhones, no cell phones, and cameras were, my mother didn't have one, so I had no pictures of the event, but it was embarrassing. Thank you.
Oh, damn, there's no pictures? I was hoping there would be pictures. The other thing is, like, how many of those outfits did they have? And what I mean by that is, was it a one size fits most? Did they have a small, a medium, and a large? Like, was this actually your size? Was it a little snug? Was it a little baggy? I want to know more.
I'm thinking baggy.
I can't tell how much that man weighed. Ain't no telling. He might have been out there red, white, and blue, and the blue coming out on that spare tire. I got no idea, man. They had chunky kids back in the day, too.
You got a good story on time when your parents embarrassed you, Bo?
Nah, my parents didn't do that. That's one thing I give my parents credit for. They not about that life. They got no joy out of embarrassing you in front of your friends. But other people, boy, I seen some others. Like, I didn't get my homegirl, God rest her soul. And she would talk about how she would ask her mama to drop her off like two blocks from the mall when she would go meet up with her friends. And I was like, damn, that's messed up. She's like, you didn't have my mama showing up with that house dress and no drawers on, like not caring about nothing. I'm like, oh, good point. I rolled a 7. Your parents about that life? They about the embarrassment life?
So my birthday is January 1st. So there's always like things going on around my birthday, whether it's like some sort of family vacation or family excursion somewhere. It's lucky because I get to do cool stuff for my birthday. But it's also that every time we would do something, my parents would say to whomever that it was my birthday. I remember this one time when I was a little kid, I was at Disney World or something like that. My dad or my mom let these like Ninja Turtles know that it was my birthday. I hate clowns, man. I know we work for Disney, but I hate stuff, kind of people wearing costumes. I just can't do it.
Your dad hadn't learned that yet. He had to get to know you a little better. You were getting to know yourself, too. It was all everybody at the same time. Although, I will say, the best birthday one of those ever in Houston, my cousin Shaka, it was his 12th birthday, and we went to Bennigan's. But you from Houston, and you know kind of the age range, so this was like 88, somewhere in there. It was the Black Bennigan's. There was a very specific Black Bennigan's. Y'all know the Black Bennigan's, you know. Anyway, so we had the Black Bennigan's. Against my cousin Shaka's 12th birthday, and people start coming down the aisle and they banging on like the trays and stuff with silverware, like, you know, it's the birthday coming. And they did what apparently was the birthday celebration at the Black Bennigan's. Daddy long stroke, daddy long stroke, daddy long stroke, daddy long stroke. As 8-year-old Bomani is like, what does that mean? And nobody told me, but I figured it out. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this 3 times a week. My man Gabe Bassain handling everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Also, thank to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Theodore Kim, professor at Yale. Check out his story on AI and potential racism at latimes.com. Thanks to Will Oramus of The Washington Post. Check out his story about what is next for Facebook at washingtonpost.com. And thanks to Jeremy Merrill of The Washington Post. Check out his story on phishing scams that allow hackers to steal passwords at washingtonpost.com. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.